This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Hello and welcome to L&G Talks Asset Management. If the past few days in markets have felt particularly hectic, you are not imagining things. From the US Supreme Court striking down of the emergency powers that were used to impose blanket trade tariffs, to a major wobble in software stocks and ongoing shifts across a range of government bond markets, there has been a lot going on. My name is Harry Brooks. I'm a content manager here at L&G. And today I'm joined by Ben Bennett, Head of Investment Strategy Asia, who'll share his take on the stories behind the headlines and what to watch in the week ahead. Ben, how have you been? Were you able to enjoy Chinese New Year despite all the drama in markets?
Yeah, absolutely. In Hong Kong and large parts of Asia, everything shuts down for the Lunar New Year, of course. So lots of people go away or go to family. We went to Dubai and Abu Dhabi, which is the first time I've spent time in these places. Spectacular places, amazing buildings and fun on the beach clubs. But also, yeah, the highlight was a Falcon Hospital, where the falcons line up and get their talons clipped. It's quite surreal stuff, but very interesting.
Excellent. Well, back to the meat of today's conversation. On Friday, the US Supreme Court ruled that President Trump's sweeping import tariffs would need congressional approval. Over the weekend, President Trump responded, saying he will impose global tariffs of 10%, and he later increased that to 15%. There's obviously a lot of unanswered questions at this point. To name just a few, what happens to the $280-something billion of revenues that the US government collected from those tariffs last year? What happens to the Section 122 provisions that could be used to impose those 15% tariffs when they expire? What then happens next? And lastly, does this mean that all the deals that were reached under the previous setup are now void? What would you say about all those?
Well, to be honest, I think your question answers itself. It's just so many questions, aren't there? And honestly, we don't know the answers to an awful lot of them. But yeah, definitely talking about clipping talons. The Supreme Court definitely got their talons into the tariffs and said, look, some of the things that President Trump used in order to enact those tariffs, these emergency powers, they rule that he can't do that. So as you say, they have to be unwound. Whether or not you get the refunds, you're seeing already companies suing the government saying, we want to get the cash back, that $280-odd billion, as you say. President Trump came out and said, we're going to do a 10% overall new tariff. And then he announced it could be 15%. I think only 10% has been announced as of recording today on Tuesday. It could be 15%. And this is a new rule that he's put in place that can last for 150 days. And then it would have to have the Congress sign off, which is, you know, up in the air, given that we've got midterms and not that far away in November, haven't we? And if he can't get Congress to sign off on this, then they would have to enact all sorts of other rules and regulations to get the tariffs back to where they were before, which involves lots of investigations. And I don't know who's doing these investigations, how long they can take. Can they all be done in 150 days? As you said, there's a lot of countries who have deals that they thought they'd struck potentially at below the 15% that President Trump has now announced, that are sort of questioning whether those deals are, look, I mean, what can we say? So big points. I think there are winners and losers out of that 15% or 10%. Like I said before, some Asian countries had higher tariffs put in place and maybe they come down now. But yeah, away from that winners and losers, the overall tariff rate is pretty much unchanged, I'd say, in general. So from a macro perspective, it doesn't have a huge impact. The second thing is say, look, tariffs, despite all the headlines that we've had, it hasn't had a major market impact, has it? Apart from the initial Liberation Day swoon and then the recovery straight away after that. So, you know, investors have shrugged their shoulders to this new development. And again, market reaction has been relatively small. Third thing I'd say, Trump does deals. I mean, President Trump likes doing deals. So we all know that when there are some aggressive statements, that can often be the opening gambit to something that comes out a little bit more positive for markets. Again, investors aren't knee-jerk reacting, aren't sort of selling off. And fourth thing I'd say, maybe on a positive point, that the Supreme Court's judgment suggests that, you know, they're not just going to roll over and allow President Trump to do whatever he wants. There are definitely some institutional guardrails, I guess. And you know, we're thinking about the Federal Reserve a lot, aren't we, on this podcast and in markets, and whether or not President Trump can influence the Federal Reserve aggressively. Again, perhaps this is a sign that there are areas where he won't be able to influence and where there will be some institutional rigor, which again, possibly is a good thing for markets, isn't it? So those are some of the things that I've thought about, but there's a huge number of questions, as you say.
Yeah, lots of uncertainty, but sounds like some grounds for optimism about the future, really. Taking a step back from the tariff uncertainty, we had some important economic data out of the US last week. US GDP growth for the fourth quarter came in at 1.4%, much lower than the 4.4% we saw in the previous quarter, and short of what economists had expected for that fourth quarter. How much of this do you think will have been to do with the US government shutdown that we saw last year? And are there any other big reasons that might help account for it?
Yeah, so the big thing is that this isn't a big issue. not a big issue. So don't worry too much about these numbers, I'd say. If you strip back some of the noisy stuff, the final private domestic demand, so sort of US private domestic, what's going on there with the consumer, etc., that rose a pretty steady 2.5%, 2.4%, I think it was, annualized. So that's fine. The reason why it came in overall lower than that was government shutdown. Look, the government shut down for a few weeks, didn't they, last year? So that trimmed a percent off. They should get that back next year, because people eventually got paid. So that yeah, you can add that back on almost. And then the other big movement that we saw is the trade deficit, which swings around about a huge amount. It was a little bit of a bigger deficit than expected a few weeks ago, which again trims some of the GDP off what was previously expected. But like I said, if you take all that, it's sort of okay. And the other thing that's going on is that the job market is not as bad as, again, some people had feared at the end of last year. We keep getting some okay job data coming through, which again suggests the consumer's doing okay. Don't worry too much. The one thing that did, I guess, concern investors a little bit was a slightly elevated PCE inflation measure, which is the one that the Fed looks at. Other bits of inflation haven't looked that bad. So again, probably one just to keep an eye on rather than get worried about. And generally, the economic macro backdrop broadly, I'd say, is still positive for markets, I'd say here.
Interesting. So a lot of detail behind that 1.4% figure. Thanks for putting some colour behind that. Finally, on the US, I wanted to ask about the big falls that we've seen in some software companies over the last month-ish. I understand that this all stems from concerns about AI and how that might erode their competitive advantages in the future. But what specifically led to this latest sell-off?
Yeah, and frankly, this is where all the market reaction is coming from. We're talking about tariffs, we're talking about GDP. Those things are interesting, but markets have reacted really to this AI. So if you just look at the S&P 500, and again, we're talking on Tuesday, the 24th of February, the S&P is pretty much flat on the year, so boring, and nothing's happening. But then you drill into that, about a quarter of the S&P 500, so 125 companies roughly, they have moved plus or minus 20% so far this year. So a large chunk of the S&P 500 has had a very volatile start of the year. And making it, I guess, oversimplifying, you could say that companies with tangible assets, so energy companies, sort of utilities, companies that maybe almost the boring companies, they're doing quite well because, you know, they can't be AI'd away, can they? And then there's a group of companies that are doing quite poorly because investors are a little bit concerned that AI could undermine their business model. Software is the one that's really in the headlines. And, you know, the software sector of the S&P 500 is down about 30% since its peak back in October. So the whole sector is down a chunk since its peak. But there's other sectors as well that have done relatively badly as well because of this AI question. And it's, yeah, it's really, really interesting right now. And just plenty of people talking, plenty of papers going around analyzing this. I'd say the bullish argument for AI is that it will develop into a fabulously highly productive part of all of our lives. So it'll do a lot of jobs for us. It could even drive inflation lower because everything's going to be cheaper. I mean, that's why software companies are going down, because maybe all the software that we currently pay a monthly subscription for, you don't need to, because there's going to be really, really cheap versions of that coming out. Maybe that will lead to low interest rates could create new jobs. I mean, no one can predict where the new jobs come from. There'll definitely be jobs lost, but they'll just be developed into new jobs and highly economic activities. That's the bullish case. And the bearish case is it could lead to that high unemployment initially that could lead to lower consumption. You know, people just haven't got enough money. You could have these stranded assets, all these software companies, or maybe even bigger tangible assets that suddenly aren't worth anything, that could lead to defaults because people have lent these companies too much money. Now, I'd say the answer somewhere in between. I'd say you could see a little bit of bearishness to start off with. We're seeing that right now to some degree, where we worry about that unemployment and it takes a little bit longer to get the productivity. But then investors generally will look forward and try and price in something that will happen in the next year or so. So yeah, somewhere in between. I'd say on aggregate, it's probably a bullish thing. It has to be a bullish thing overall, but there's going to be disruption. And we are definitely seeing that so far this year in that S&P dispersion.
Absolutely. So I mentioned at the start of this episode that there's been plenty going on away from the US, with some interesting shifts in government bond markets in a couple of different places. One that springs to mind is Japan, where the yield on the long-dated 30-year bond has climbed steadily over the last year-ish, but it's fallen steeply over the last month. What's behind that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the equity markets is about the AI trade, but bond markets are also very interesting right now. Japan 30-year bonds at the end of 2024, so just over a year ago, they were at about 2.25%. And then we had this period of inflation going up. We had higher fiscal spending, a new Prime Minister Takaichi who got elected, and these bonds got up to 4% nearly at the start of this year. So from two and nearly down to two up to four, doubling the yield there over just over a year. Since the election, though, a few weeks ago, the bond yields have started to fall again, and you know they're back down to 3.25% or so, those 30-year bonds. And it's almost as if investors were putting trades on in anticipation of the election and saying yields are going to be going up. And then as soon as it happened, we haven't got any more triggers left. We're just waiting now to see what Takeuchi does, what the deficit's going to be. And people are taking profits. So yields are coming down again. And I do think there's still opportunities there. Look, that 3.25%, that's still high in the context of short-dated rates being very low. The Bank of Japan's base rate's very low. 2-year yields are about 1.25%. So the 30 years, 3.25, 2 years are 1.25. That's pricing in an awful lot of rate hikes going forward. Very steep curves. I wouldn't be surprised if we continue to see that flattening of the curve. So, you know, 30-year yields coming down relative to 2-year yields. That could carry on if those yields start to normalize back to what a lot of other government bond yields are.
Interesting. The Australian government bond market has also been in the spotlight with a steady rise in yields. The Reserve Bank of Australia increased interest rates earlier this month for the first time since 2023, reversing a cut that it had made only 6 months earlier. Could this signal the start of a rate rising cycle?
Yeah, actually, I do think Australia could be the most interesting market to keep an eye on, because as you say, they hiked interest rates less than 6 months after cutting interest rates the last time. And that shows you that things can change pretty quickly. They hiked interest rates because they were worried about inflation. They're worried about how the unemployment situation is. Employment is strong. Unemployment's relatively low. So they have to hike interest rates. Whereas 6 months ago, you know, by cutting interest rates back then, they were worried, I guess, that the economy was going to slow down. So things can change really quickly. And that's not uncommon. So we're talking about rate cuts still in the UK, rate cuts in Federal Reserve, rate cuts in the ECB coming forward. It might not be long before we start talking about rate hikes again. And I think, you know, if this productivity miracle does take place that we are thinking about with AI, and we know that Kevin Warsh, the new Federal Reserve governor, is going to be banging on about this a lot because he's a big proponent of this productivity, is going to be a brilliant thing. Then that productivity presumably is going to happen all over the world. It's not just going to be about the US. And if it does happen all over the world, then, you know, maybe we need lower interest rates all over the world, just because inflation is going to be lower. You need fewer people. productivity generally should lead to lower interest rates for the same level of unemployment, etc. So, you know, there are markets that which look attractive under that basis, and Australia would be one of those. They've got high bond yields, and if productivity does take place, then that, again, that could be interesting. So maybe Australia is the place to invest if you're bullish about AI, not just in the S&P, but you can start thinking about bond markets too.
Okay, well, having covered international debt markets, I wanted to ask you as well about international equities. I saw last week's Bank of America fund manager survey showed that an overweight in emerging market equities at the moment is the biggest consensus trade going. But while Korea and Taiwan have been benefiting from the AI theme, and several LATAM countries, I think, are doing well based on commodity exposure, there's been one notable underperformer within emerging markets over the past year, China. I've read plenty of people making the bull case for China recently, pointing to government efforts to encourage corporates to focus on lifting return on equity, share buybacks, and the country's really significant role in AI model development, and how that combines with cheap electricity that could be used to power the data centers that are needed by AI. Why hasn't any of this translated into better performance recently?
Yeah, I think the question is really that China could have done even better, because actually the Chinese markets haven't done badly over, since the end of 2024, again, so just over a year. The CSI 300, which would be the onshore China markets, up about 18%. The Hang Seng here in Hong Kong's up about 20%. That's not bad. But yeah, in the context of the KOSPI in South Korea, up 144%. That's a definite underperformance. And you mentioned some other. And look, you could also argue that China is in a good place for AI, energy you mentioned, DeepSeek developments. You know, it's behind the US, but it's probably in second place. So why is it only done, as you say, sort of 20%? Why is that underperformed? Well, I do think Chinese companies generally over the years have underperformed the GDP, partly because there is a focus more on more market share, more on providing benefits to the population, as opposed to just straight out profits, which is a much more of a US stroke Western ideal, isn't it, for companies? So if you're a shareholder, you're not the only thing that is potentially in the company's trying to look after. China is also still suffering from that massive debt overhang from the property market. We forget that, don't we? But that was a huge debt bubble that is still working its way through the system. Banks have still got a lot of bad loans on their balance sheets, and property market is still going down in terms of prices. So I think that is also a bit of a drag. And then the third thing is China policymakers have decided not to unleash a round of stimulus in a relatively weak macro backdrop. You know, inflation's low, consumption domestic market is relatively weak. They're really only doing well from exports from a GDP perspective. So, you know, that's another reason why it's just lagging a bit. So interestingly, we could have had the same conversation about South Korea just over a year ago. And in fact, we probably did, that it had lagged. No. And there's a lot of reasons why it lagged. And then suddenly it takes off and it goes up 100-odd%. So maybe China is on the foothills of a rally that we could see over the next couple of years. I'd be a little bit concerned, though, because of those structural issues that I've just listed. So, yeah, I can see why it might continue to disappoint relative to other AI-type trades.
Some big long-term themes there to think about. Okay, well, we've reached that point of the podcast where you get the chance to highlight the stories that I've neglected to include on my script of questions. What's your number of the week for us this time around?
So my number's going to be the reason why you've neglected it, because it's boring. Eight basis points, so 0.08%. That is the range, the spread range of investment-grade corporate bonds so far this year. So they're, you know, the risk associated with investment-grade credit has stayed virtually unchanged all year, despite what I've just said about bond markets, about emerging markets, about S&P 500 dispersion. Really, 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 really boring. High yield, US high yield, has had a bit of a larger range, slightly larger, 30 basis points. Again, that's not huge, but we are starting to see some cracks appearing around that AI loser. I mentioned the bearish argument about AI, which is that you could see stranded assets. Now, a lot of software companies have raised debt and they've raised it in particular in private markets. That seems to be the place that they've raised it over the last few years. And we are starting to see some bond spreads within the public markets, because you can see the pricing there, starting to widen in that sector, starting to weaken a bit. Now, if we were to see a proper issue with some of these companies and some of their business models, and you start to see stranded assets, that's where you're going to see the problems within the high yield, private, partly public markets. So we've got an eye on that. So far, very little sign of it, particularly in the investment grade market, but just some creaking going on in the high yield market. So that's one to watch.
We will keep an eye on that 8 basis point spread and see where it goes from here. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today, Ben. Always much appreciated. And I look forward to talking to you on the next episode of Market Talk.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.